Mark Pesce is with us now to talk about what's happening in the world of tech. Welcome, Mark.
Good morning, Catherine.
This is a subject that we have touched on previously on 9 to Noon, the tracking going on, and particularly just listening to Kim talk about the Roe v. Wade case and the expected overturn of that by the Supreme Court if that decision is confirmed. A lot of concerns about the intimate information that can be tracked. And what's your take on this story?
So earlier this month, Vice, which is one of the major news outlets, spent $160, so not a lot of money, and bought a week's worth of tracking data for all of the Planned Parenthood locations in the United States. Now, that was not individual data per se, but they could certainly tell the number of people and what times of day they were there. That data came from a company called SafeGraph. SafeGraph effectively provides some tools, some program code that developers can bake into their mobile apps that then gives a stream of location data to SafeGraph, and SafeGraph will pay the developers for this. So this is a way for developers to make money, which is why they do it. But then SafeGraph will then collate this data around the brands that they track. And Planned Parenthood, apparently, even though it's not one thing, it's different in every state, but it's considered a brand. And you can then buy location data by brand. Now, you might want to say how many people are coming to my supermarket or to my laundromat or to my restaurant. In this case, how many people are coming to a place that might be offering termination services to women.
Can you explain again how this is possible? How is the data sourced, and what exactly is it?
So you got to think about all of the apps that are on your phone, right? And the developers write some of the code in those apps, but there's a lot of code that they can get that's basically pre-baked, and they'll add it in because it'll add a function they need. And then there's other code that they'll add in. You think some apps actually have ads that run in the background, which is how the developer pays for it so you can use it for free. So similar to that, they'll add in this code, which rather than displaying an ad inside the app, will continually send the location of the device back to SafeGraph so that they know where a device is, not a specific device, because at the very least, the data is anonymized. So it's not saying this is your phone, but this is saying a phone that is at a place at a period of time. And they've got now lots of apps on everyone's phone that have this data in it that's feeding back into SafeGraph. So SafeGraph is sitting on more and more and more location data that's organized around these brands. And SafeGraph has done this so well that they got, I think, $45 million U.S. dollars in venture capital last year, including from Peter Thiel, who's a well-known investor and New Zealand citizen. So they're using this data to basically be able to track consumer behavior. But what we're now seeing is that that data can also then be weaponized for whatever purpose you want. We know that the Centers for Disease Control bought a lot of data from SafeGraph last year to understand how COVID was spreading and how people were moving during lockdowns. So that's a really useful, helpful case of that data. But now when you're talking about things like Planned Parenthood, it's got a very different kind of flavor to it.
You say it's anonymized. It's a phone, not your phone or my phone. Yeah. But actually, it is your phone or my phone. So while the owners of that data might not know your name necessarily, can they target you with very specific messaging and could say someone wanting to go to an abortion clinic or have an appointment there be directly targeted because that device is their device?
So we know that in 2016, in fact, a man who runs an internet advertising agency actually did target ads to women who were sitting in Planned Parenthood. He probably didn't know who the women were exactly, but he knew the devices that he could target, and he sent them push ads, which basically were about reconsidering their decision. And that sort of opened the door to this. So we know that that is possible. The other thing we also know is possible is that while one particular set of location data may not identify you precisely, generally, if you take multiple sets, and remember, there are multiple apps tracking in multiple ways simultaneously on your device, you can basically lay them against one another, and it's almost like the intersection between all of them is you. So it's much easier to be able to identify someone specifically than we would like to think.
Stay first with the case of Roe v. Wade and the implications for Planned Parenthood and the implications for individual women seeking abortions. We also talked about, can that phone be tracked across state lines, for example, and could that data end up being evidence in a court case were there to be criminalization again in some states?
And the answer to that is very likely yes. I mean, again, we're talking about getting through that an anonymity barrier, but current technology means that that's not the problem. Really, although each of these apps individually are anonymous, when you start putting them together, they de-anonymize you.
And they but the phone is still your device, right? And the data knows the specific phone. It doesn't know who the owner of the phone is. But were that to be seized by police, for example, let's get away from this immediate case, can that tracking be part of the picture?
Very possibly.
Okay. You mentioned also how these different apps sort of end up overlaid against each other. There was another case I referenced the last time we talked about this of the Monsignor, the Catholic priest or Monsignor in the United States, who ended up being outed by a publication, a Catholic publication, for his use of Grindr. And again, as I understand it, it was his phone and that was used to identify his use of that app. Is that a case, again, where the data was purchased? The data that linked the phone to an app.
Yes, and I mean, I think you can probably take a look at the location data, because the Monsignor would probably have had a very specific location that would have been very easy to identify as being specific to him and his
use. A presbytery, right?
Whereas, and it's also now known that, in fact, Grindr does sell its location data, right? And I think that a lot of people were using it without understanding that that was the case. That is also now clear. And so it's when you get things that are reasonably specific about an individual, it makes that process of identification that much easier.
So cheap, this data, too, isn't it? And no limits on who can buy it.
And this is exactly where there's going to have to be a big step up in the amount of legal protection. So just overnight in America, we had a Democratic senator from Oregon essentially insisting that Google now start to put strong protections into their location data supply precisely for this reason, because everyone expects that Roe will be repealed sort of in the next 30 days and that this will now become an issue of law. And therefore, you shouldn't be selling data that could compromise people legally.
Staying with Roe v. Wade and the whole social upheaval, I guess, that it has provoked or certainly stoked over that issue some 50 years on, Meta is a strange organisation, isn't it? Some of us still call it Facebook. But what's happening there with respect to this?
So essentially, Meta has banned any discussion of abortion on its internal. So there's an internal Facebook, which gets used by employees, which is called, now what is it called? Workplace, all right? And so they all are sharing all this stuff on it. And specifically in 2019, Meta issued a blanket ban for any discussions of abortion because they said, look, people are really sensitive about this issue. And there are similar bans around trans issues, around Black Lives Matter, because it's just been found that it makes the employees fight. Now that Roe is coming into question, the people inside of Facebook are going, look, this is the time we actually do need to have this conversation. We need to have that ban removed. So far, Facebook's ban internally stands. They're inviting their employees to use regular Facebook to have those conversations. In other words, to feed into Facebook's way that it incites division and argument in order to increase users.
So just help me with this. They protect and censor their own internal Facebook, but for everyone else, you can do whatever you like, whatever the cost. Is that it?
That seems to be the case.
Okay. Back to work or not back to work. This is really getting interesting, isn't it? As we learn how our behaviour is going to change or not change or maybe change a bit, but not as much as we thought it was going to change. And the real standoff between the employers and the employees.
Yeah. And this is a story about, so Ian Goodfellow was the head of machine learning at Apple, which means, you know, when, for instance, if you open up your iPhone and it's scanning your face to recognize you, that is machine learning. And Apple is really good at it because Ian Goodfellow is one of the founding fathers of the field. All right. That's how important he is. And at the beginning of the month, he resigned unexpectedly, very suddenly from Apple. He said, I believe strongly that more flexibility in Apple's back to work policy would have been the best policy for my team. He wanted to be able to say, look, we don't need to go back into the office 3 days a week. We can decide. Our team can decide. That policy was not changed, and so he resigned. Around a week later, it was announced that he was going to Google, which is where he had come from. He's working on DeepMind. So this is an enormous loss for Apple and an enormous win for Google. On the same day, Apple reversed its position on its back-to-work policy.
What was the case it made and how to its workers?
So, you know, Tim Cook was basically saying 1 day a week in April, 2 days a week beginning of May, 3 days a week by the end of May. And about 75% of all Apple employees were actually upset with that policy, and maybe as much as 60% were actually thinking of looking for new jobs. And it doesn't seem like Apple's management heard the employee dissatisfaction around this, and this is part of the blowback of that.
Did he explain his reasons, though, why he wanted people back together again?
I mean, yes. And I mean, you know, we do know that we collaborate well in groups. You want the esprit de corps. You want the kind of quote unquote productivity gains that you get from people working together. But I think also, particularly in Silicon Valley, people are saying, well, that's 2 hours of commuting a day that are lost time. And I'm not really sure if that's really a worthwhile investment. We seem to be working well at home for the last 2 years. So it feels as though it felt more like a mandate rather than a conversation. And I think Ian Goodfellow was really reacting to the fact that they weren't trying to negotiate this with the groups. They were trying to mandate it across the org.
That's a different beast, isn't it? And that says something to leadership style and, again, the evolution that any number of companies, and particularly in tech, because let's face it, if you're in tech, you're probably way more comfortable with a lot of the remote gadgets and much more comfortable with, you know, staring at boxes all day than I am, that's for sure. So it really is sort of ground zero for the shake-up here, isn't it? And it just suggests more about the leadership style and the... It's bigger than just where you're going to work from, isn't it? It's about how are we going to work together.
Yes, and I don't think anyone's got all of the answers on that yet, but it seems like exactly the wrong position is to simply shut down discussion and to simply mandate this is the way it's going to be. In part because, as we know, there's a huge shortage of tech workers. And so anyone who leaves Apple is immediately going to get a great job somewhere else. And by the way, Ian Goodfellow will be able to work from home for Google. They made that very clear in their statement when they hired him. So that's kind of Google sticking it in Apple's eye around this policy.
Now, the deep fake holiday photos are truly terrifying. I suppose you could either make yourself look absolutely amazing when you're not, or someone else could, create a monster themselves. Is this a funny story or a terrifying story?
No, this is a very funny story. A fellow went scuba diving. A fellow named Matt Bell went scuba diving, and he took a whole bunch of beautiful photos when he was scuba diving sort of in Coral Reefs. And he actually used – there's a lovely new program called DALL-E, D-A-L-L-E, so a pun on Salvador Dali, that can create artworks algorithmically using artificial intelligence. And he used it to create some new kinds of sea creatures, which he put into the photos, and he shared them around with his friends, and his friends thought they were all the real deal. He's like, oh, so they clearly passed the human test of not being weird, not being so strange, but just being strange enough because they're deep sea creatures that they really got us in our sweet spot.
I can't see what's wrong with them. There's something slightly wrong with the crayfish, which I'm just eyeing up. But they look really real to me. What am I missing? Do you have to keep staring?
No. I think the thing is that, in fact, I think part of it's our expectations for sea creatures are that they're a little weird. And so I think probably our boundaries are a little different there. But it's also that the software is so good now at looking at other sea creatures and kind of mixing it up and saying, well, here's something that will look reasonable. And by the way, the way that all of this works underneath the hood is the technology that Ian Goodfellow developed at Apple.
Oh, there you go.
To tie that back in. So yeah, a lot of this is really how good this technology has now become.
Look, it's a lovely light story, but we do worry about the implications for deepfake. And how much conversation is happening in Silicon Valley about that? Often a case where they go ahead and do stuff and we talk about the issues with it later. How aware are they of the, you know, potentially catastrophic risks of deepfake involving world leaders, say, I don't know, we can all imagine what catastrophe it might invoke.
Yeah. Look, I think they're all deeply aware. I think maybe part of the problem is they're trying to find a solution by throwing more technology at the problem. And that may not be like they want a computer program that will always be able to detect a deepfake. But all you then do is basically evolve a better deepfake that computer program can't detect. So it becomes an arms race. And it feels like the answer there is to avoid the arms race, but to look for other kinds of authenticity in our media that will let us know that things are real, rather than relying on the computers to either lie to us or to try to tell us that's the truth.
Good stuff, Mark. Thank you. Mark Pesce.
Thank you.